Right. Okay. So, do you have any questions? Any questions? No? Okay. You can see it's quite well today. Good idea. Yes, excellent. Thank you. People may come, but who knows? So, question number one. What is a novel?
A lengthy narration.
Three acts. Okay.
Bueno, no todo lo de nuevo está, es experto para la por está.
Okay, anything to add? Okay, so the novel needs to be long. Well, so, okay. Why then? Because I think according to your definition, something like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight would be a novel. Why is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight not a novel? Or is it a novel? Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, yes.
Well, novels are normally written in prose.
Okay.
Sir Gawain is written in verse.
Right.
That's our difference. Novels normally are more realistic,
Right.
at least at the beginning, and psychological. They develop more a psychology of that.
Right.
Sir Gawain, for example, the characters are more archetypical.
Good. Okay. So, long prose fiction. So prose is quite important, although we will see experiments in the 19th century with verse novels, not very successful experiments. And there should be a normally a unified narrative. So if something is very episodic, we wouldn't really consider it a mature novel. And it should be anchored in social and psychological specifics. So it's not just happening sometime a long time ago, but it's happening in a particular place at a particular time to specific people who should be, in one sense or another, identifiable. So credibility and probability are essential. So, why is it ironic that we are arguing that novels appear in the early 18th century in their mature form? Well, we could say this for two reasons. One is the fact that there's a tendency to reject antiquity, so you're talking about the here and now, in what we tend to call the Augustan age, or the neoclassical age. And both Augustan and neoclassical suggest a respect for antiquity, so that's slightly weird, if you like. And also, ironically, there is an increasing acceptance that novels are stories entirely made up by their authors. So this is a product of the author's mind. In the name novel, there is the idea that it is something new. But there is simultaneously a requirement to create a narrative that could have actually happened in the real world around the reader. So, if to some extent the idea in the past was the author is not that important because the story should already exist, now the author is very important because she or he is the creator of the story. But at the same time, we enter into, between writer and reader, a sort of agreement to imagine that it's true, even though both parties know that it isn't. How is the emergence of the novel related to our old friend William Congreve? Who was William Congreve? The author of The Way of the Wild, correct, 1 point. How is he important in the emergence of the novel? Just too risky, I think. He wrote what, for a lot of people, is the first important literary criticism of the novel in the introduction or the preface to his novella Incognita from 1692, which he wrote when he was something like 17, which is far too young. He distinguished between the aims and methods of earlier romances and the realism of the new novels. That differentiation is important, although, of course, that comment is predating anything that we would recognize as a full novel by quite a number of years, by over 20 years. So that's curious, if you like. But that is the case. So, question number two. Why didn't the modern novel emerge before the 18th century? Okay, the literary tradition mainly focused on poetry and plays. That's a description of the change, not an explanation of the non-change, if you like. Obviously, the literary tradition didn't focus on the things that are for a novel until novels emerged. So it's a little bit circular, although it's valid. Any other reasons? Okay, good. So there were economic reasons, which we will talk about a bit later. I think the first thing to say is that it is slightly childish and nationalistic to see the novel emerging in the 18th century in England. The novel is a very, very long, slow process. And playing sort of nationalistic games saying which is the first novel is a pretty sterile process. We have Egyptian things that have elements of novels, ancient Egyptian things. We have Roman things by Juvenal, I believe, that are pretty much like science fiction novels. We have things like Rambler. We have The Tales of Genji. Have either of you read The Tales of Genji? So it's an 11th century book about a Japanese courtesan. And it's actually very readable. I read it when I was quite young. The reason why you wouldn't say it was the first novel is because, it's very episodic. You have little stories about her and it doesn't really, go anywhere in that sense, but it's quite clearly invented by the author, and it's set in a particular place and time, blah, 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 blah. We can say the same sort of thing about Don Quixote, we could say that the English novel starts with The Unfortunate Traveller by Thomas Nash, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare. Or we could say it started with Richard Head's The English Rogue from 1665. So it's just a little bit silly to play games and pretend that there is a beginning for novels and there is a first novel. I don't think it's particularly useful. However, all of the authors we saw last year, Chaucer, Spenser, Shakespeare, Milton, etc., based their stories on traditional plots because they accepted the general premise that of their times, that since nature was essentially complete and unchanging, God who created the world, and God who created the world complete, its records, whether spiritual, legendary, or historical, constituted a definitive repertoire of stories. So all of the potential stories you could ever have already existed, and all that you would happen if somebody was to write a new narrative of some sort was that they're making a variation on it. And that, of course, is seen as a good thing. So it's important, and it's a good thing, that King Lear is based on previous King Lears, which are based on previous King Lears, etc., etc. It's important that the Knight's Tale, which is what he's looking at 515, is based on previous stories that are basically exactly the same story with slight variations. That is a good thing. The idea of novelty is basically a bad thing. And as we saw last year, we even have some people occasionally pretending that their story is based on something older, even though we know that it isn't, just because if they just completely made it up, that would devalue it. So there's that huge mind shift between it should be based on something beforehand and that's copying, which would be our attitude today. So that means that literature, or narrative literature, before this date is essentially backward looking. Yeah, because you're wanting to base yourself on something previous, you're basically talking about fundamental values of unchanging humanity. The Romance had offered a world of wonder without rational sequence or consequence. Things to some extent just happen in something like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. They're just episodes that happen. It's not, there's not the same process of cause and effect. You could very strongly argue that, to some extent, in that particular way, romance has as much to do with reality as novels do. Because a lot of things just happen. They're not cause and effect, as much as tends to be the case in novels. But there had been a belief in a divine plan which could be rigidly applied to everyone in all situations. How does the novel change the social focus of romance and epic? Right, okay. So they tend to focus on middle class people, probably. In some cases, yes, on underclass people, as we might want to call them. The focus of romance and epic is the knights and the monarchy, so kings and knights. Any other common factors about the focus of romance and epic? Knights, heroes, kings. Exactly, good. So basically men, right? Noble men, aristocratic men in some sense, but definitely men. So there are some female characters, but they are almost always secondary characters in epic or in romance. The lower class had appeared before, but primarily in stage comedy and to some extent in picaresque narratives. By contrast, the monarchy effectively disappeared from novels in the 18th century, and aristocrats were not usually the primary focus. So you might have a Lord Charles Grandison in the novel by Fielding as the main character. This is the case. But in most of them, like Tom Jones or like Pride and Prejudice or whatever, there may be some aristocrats knocking around in the background, but they are not the primary focus of the story. How did people start? Sorry, I have my special slide, so I'll show you my special slide. How did people start to read differently? We have pigeons. Yeah? Any idea? Internet people, Carlos, Maria, how did people start to read differently? Okay, so before the modern era, most people's relationship with books was books being read to them, because most people were illiterate. But also, there was the idea of attentive focus on a relatively small number of books, because books were expensive. So, the Bible, the Consolation of Philosophy, the commonplace books and poetry were read slowly and carefully and often listened to. In this period, it has been identified by people who understand these things, people basically started to skim read. Do you understand skim reading? Yeah, well, reading silently and faster than you would, because I mean, it's perfectly possible to read silently, but read at the speed that you would if you weren't, to read faster than you could if you were reading aloud. How does that affect a text? Right, you probably have a more shallow understanding of the text. Anything else? Come on, online people. If you're not listening to a text, what becomes less important? The pigeon moves. No? Well, the sonority of the text. If you're not listening to it, the fact that there is rhyme, that there is meter, that there is poetics becomes much less important. Yeah? Because you're not actually hearing it. I mean, you may sort of hear it in your head and your the voice in your mind, but they are necessarily less important. And so poetry becomes less important and verse drama declines. So, and as you begin to have drama like something like The Way of the World, which is in prose, then there's obviously another reason to promote prose in general. So novels, unlike previous literature, were easy to understand and fun to skim read. If you try and skim read Paradise Lost, because it's complicated syntax and blah, 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 you're not going to get anything out of it and you're going to get lost very, very quickly. You know, even though the actual time period between one and the other, you know, is not actually very great. So there is that idea of a text which you are consuming rapidly, much more rapidly than the previous text, because there are plenty of other novels to read. So, as the abundance of texts increases, I mean, if you're only really ever going to read the Bible in your life, then you're going to read it slowly, because that's all you're ever going to read. If you're going to be reading a novel a week, or some of my students read two novels a day occasionally, if they weren't complete Libra files or whatever, but obviously that's not that common. We don't have that much free time, but novels obviously you consume in a different way. Was there a fundamental shift towards secularism? All these nice people sitting around. Secularism is a situation where people can be religious, but there is a separation between church and state, and it's not the same as a sort of theocracy where religion is a central part of public life and political life, etc. Yep. Okay. So we need to be careful about this. Almost everyone in the 18th century believed that miracles could happen. It was common knowledge. Everybody accepted the fact that God created the world on the 23rd of October, 4004 BC. That on the 7th of December, 2349 BC, the Great Flood started, and that on Monday the 11th of May, 1491 BC, God parted the Red Sea for Moses. Yeah, everything had been fully calculated in a time frame, and these things were just accepted as truth. This is still until the very beginning of the 19th century, and we have Lovell, I think it's called, we have the concept of geological time, and all of this nonsense gets thrown out of the window, except in the United States. But we'll forget about them. So, moreover, the most widely read and discussed collection of narratives in 18th century England was undoubtedly Scripture, the Bible. Yeah, that is what people are reading more than anything else. That is the one book that you're going to find in practically every middle class, at least, home. I mean, obviously some people were too poor and too illiterate to have a Bible, but that is the one book you would expect to find in every home. Gradually, that would be, perhaps the Book of Common Prayer as well. Gradually, as the century progresses, the complete works of Shakespeare would get an equivalent place in British culture to the Bible, because we're weird. That was the case at the beginning of the century. The trade in scriptural commentary was by far the most thriving part of the book trade in the 1700s. So people are choosing generally to read books about scripture before reading novels. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which is an entirely religious work, was the most often reprinted narrative in the entire 18th century. Most people still went to church every Sunday. The majority of people still did that. So it's relatively easy to paint a sort of agnostic society. It's not actually the case. So we should not exaggerate the changes that took place in thought and world view. Having said that, people increasingly felt that the age of miracles had passed, and that was actually quite a common phrase from the late 17th century onwards. The idea that there was an age where miracles happened, which is the Bible, but miracles don't happen anymore. They're like two fundamental ages, and that's an aspect of the modern age. So they did not expect inexplicable events in their lives. Science suggested that the world could be understood through the application of reason. Indeed, the most influential prose work of the 18th century English literature was a book called Don Quixote, a work that systematically dismantles stories shaped by miracles. Cervantes' work can be seen as an assault on the underlying premises of romance, and it is an appeal to the probable and to reality. Of course, in this type of situation, what we get is new fictions. They're still fictions, but they are new fictions. And things like, for example, the idea that the central fiction of economics, that human beings are rational. If you watch people, when is Black Friday? soonish, no? They started to advertise things about Black Friday. Do you know when Black Friday is? No. The day that the sales start before Christmas. Yeah. It's quite soon, I think. I'm not very interested in these things, but I think it's quite soon. It may be like a month before Christmas. I don't know. But anyway, so Thanksgiving is meant to be the third something of November, the third weekend of November, I think. So yeah, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. But if you observe people on Black Friday, then you will see very clearly that human beings are not rational in their economic decisions, I think. Those influenced by the new ideas wanted stories of cause and effect in which things happen for a reason. Yeah? And that is not necessarily the truth, but that appeals, of course, to a mind that wants a predictable society, and it appeals to a rational mind. Without apocalyptic goals, revelatory visions, or dramatic conversions. So, if you like, there are the elements of a detective story in the sense that you are playing a game with the writer, as a reader, you're playing a game with the writer where the writer is putting clues in and you are being encouraged to try to predict what will happen. If everything is completely predictable, you won't find it enjoyable. But if nothing is predictable, and you can't sort of have the feeling that I thought that might happen, that is equally unenjoyable, and that's really what the romances were. So from that view of rationalism, that ability, at least after the event, I think probably it would be fair to say that we would tend to see the cleverest novelists as people who can have us thinking after the event, right, now I see how that was relevant, but not necessarily beforehand. Maybe sometimes you do it beforehand. But so there is that process. The great emphasis of romance, of satire, of spiritual biography was on teaching the reader how to live, on moral lessons. And the innovation was stories whose fictions was that they showed us how people actually live rather than how they should live. Okay? Now, we have the game, for example, in the introduction of Moll Flanders, that like spiritual biographies, we have a moral lesson, yeah, that we should be learning from her mistakes. But that is really difficult to actually, when you think about it consciously, it's really difficult to uphold the reality of that, because she doesn't suffer when she's bad and have good things happen to her when she's good. We couldn't even say that if she didn't become a thief, if she didn't become a prostitute, her life would have been easier. There's nothing to suggest that in the novel. So when I go home, I noticed this this morning, and I didn't have access to my historical Oxford dictionary. But there's a mention in the preface of Moll Flanders that the fictional Daniel Defoe as author says that she pretended to be penitent. And I'm not sure if that is an older meaning of pretend, or the modern meaning of pretend, as in Finkliert, or if there is an intentional ambiguity there, which is quite possible as well, that he's playing games with that word. But I have to check that when I go home. So that game of saying this is a work which is, I'm only talking about these terrible things because you need to learn from this sinner, I cannot believe that can be serious, personally. I mean, just the way that the story holds together, the way that there is no cause and effect in relation to repentance and things getting better, et cetera, or behaving badly and things getting worse, would suggest that that is meant to be a hollow idea. So, there are often references to divine justice and teleology, but they rang increasingly hollow. Do you understand teleology? What's teleology? Yeah? You are completely a silhouette now, because all the light is behind you. So, if I'm looking at you strangely, it's not because I'm looking at you strangely, I'm trying to see something. Well, maybe. I don't want you to be so in so much darkness that you can't. Don't move. You don't have to move. Yeah, no. But, okay, bring it down a bit more. But still, I can see no features on her face at all. Bit better. Well, yeah. I mean, there's less glare, but I still cannot see your face at all. Anyway, what happens if you turn on that light? Sorry, if you turn on this light, that might help. It might also make the screen less. Can you still see the screen okay?
Yes.
Maybe there might be too much light. Well, okay, if you want to try. this is what you miss by not coming to class, all of this fun. Yes, I can see you with speckles. You now have speckled light, which is much more interesting. Right, okay, so, so teleology, that was what I was asking about. Teleology is the idea that things progress towards a specific end. So, you may remember from last year, I talked about the teleological paradox. And the teleological paradox is that when you have a narrative, you have to, the reader wants a conclusion, but also wants to know what happens afterwards, sort of thing. So there's a double feeling of unhappiness, potential unhappiness about the end of a story. And, I mean, you have things like, in terms of, audiovisual things, one of the most successful, according to critics, processes of dealing with the teleological paradox was the ending of 6 Feet Under. Dos metros bajo tierra. Did you see that? Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a series about a funeral parlor. But at the ending, they sort of take you into the future lives of the people, etc., etc. Yeah. Yeah. And so you sort of get a feeling that your time period that you've seen them in has closed, but you get some idea of what happens afterwards. The standard, of course, solution for that in drama is marriage, which is the end of one type of life, or death, which is obviously the end of one type of life. But there's still a sort of uncomfortableness about what happens at the end. And, I mean, we can see examples of that paradox in something like the end of The Tempest, if you remember from last year. It's not quite clear what's going to happen to the characters. We have to imagine what's going to happen to them, and that can be slightly awkward. From a typical Judeo-Christian point of view, everything is sort of towards an end, as well, especially a Christian point of view, I suppose. But the idea that there will be an end of time, and you'll have a last judgment and things like that. And also that human life is a progression towards some type of judgment at the end of your life, etc. So having to behave virtuously, etc. That, of course, is nothing. There's nothing fundamentally natural or normal about seeing the world like that. And you have other cultures which have much more cyclical concepts, like Buddhism, etc. So, but that is a very, very strong idea in Western culture. Once you have that idea, then you will see you want cause and effect leading towards a specific end. So, the, you know, and that's very much what you would get in a story like Every Man, to quote something else from last year. Right. How are the philosophical conditions conducive to the rise of the novel? Right, okay.
That mental change, because, for example, a theater play is staged in front of a big audience.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to deliver a message to the whole society.
Mm-hmm.
But now the novels, because the society is getting more individualistic.
Okay, all of that is true. The last part about individualism, we're definitely going to come back to. Right, well, so first there's the abandoning of a belief in a divine plan that could be rigidly applied to everyone in all situations. God has decided that the world is doing this and will end like this, and we're just part of that. People stop thinking so much in those terms. For a really long time, there was the idea that, and I mean, there still is in the United States, I think something like, something crazy, like 40% of Americans think that the end of days will happen in their lifetime. They have no concept of history. But the whole, you know, concept of the rapture and all of these types of things that the Americans have, is still part of that over 2,000 years later. But I mean, you know, everybody was expecting the world to end in the year 1,000. Blah, 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 constantly, you know, shifting it back. Because of the new rationalism, people sort of began to see that, although we're living on a volcano, if you like, the probability that the volcano will erupt in our specific time is relatively unlikely. So major 17th century philosophers like Descartes, insist on calling Descartes, and Locke, this is Locke, that's Locke over there, looking not very happy, had both emphasized the importance of individual experience. And so, as you mentioned, individualism becomes increasingly important. The interest in character as reflected in the Augustan novels was, to a large extent, a result of this change in thinking about humanity's role and destiny in the world. Okay, but to have new novels, we have to have new novelists. So, where did the 18th century novelists come from? Right. So if they're already writing other kinds of fiction, why would they shift to the novel? Right. Are there any other reasons? Apart from the success of the novel? Yes, I mean, that's probably a good reason, but any reasons why specific people might choose to write novels rather than other types of popular literature, or any other reasons why other types of literature might decline? Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Why were the main consumers of novels women? They have more free time. Why did they suddenly have free time? Right. So, not women, but ladies. So, middle class women. You moved from a 17th and previous century idea that women would naturally participate in the family business as a middle class concept. And we even have some cases in the 17th century, for example, of the family business is portrait painting, and the family discovers that the wife actually is a better portrait painter than the man, and so the man is the one who's mixing the paints and the woman is doing the painting. So as the scale of business increases, as you no longer have a situation where the family lives above the shop in the sense of both tienda and taller, it could be either, there is a separation of family from business, and therefore there is increasingly the idea of creating useless women, if you like, where women are not expected to work. And it is increasingly an embarrassment that women do work for the family. So they have a lot more free time and a lot less interesting, productive things to do. Right, and so why might women want to write novels rather than other things? To some extent, but I mean, we have things like Lady Pembroke's Calendar, and we have things by Catherine, I've forgotten her name, and Lady Mary Roth, and Aphra Behn. And there's actually, I mean, there's a reasonable sort of number of precedents of women writing, not epic poetry, it's true, but writing poetry. And writing masks, though I think probably less full-blown plays. What's the problem with writing plays for women? It's a very sort of public process, writing a play. And so that turns you into a sort of public woman, which was possible but slightly dangerous, slightly scandalous at the time of Aphra Behn, 25 years earlier. As the 18th century starts, that becomes increasingly dangerous. Whereas, of course, if you're writing a novel as a woman, you can do so in absolute anonymity. You can take on a male name, J.K. Rowling, or Acton Bell for and Bronte, et cetera, et cetera. And you are not in the public sphere in the same sort of way. So you can make money from writing, but you don't have to actually expose yourself in the same sort of way. So, yeah?
So, in order to become a writer, you need to participate in the writing part of the place as well, or do you just...
I don't know the problem is the word have to. I don't know whether you have to participate, but I would imagine that an audience would want to see the author at the end of a production sort of come out on the stage, the sort of thing that we see today in the theatre. A lot of the people who were actually working in the theatre, were of very, very humble origins. Some of the women who were appearing on stage were sort of beautiful prostitutes, especially in the late 17th century. So it wasn't seen as a particularly salubrious world, certainly backstage. And so you have people like Aphra Behn sort of getting away with it, but she was slightly unusual in that, and that became increasingly problematic afterwards. Nobody's going to sort of, if you produce a novel and you eventually tell somebody, yes, I wrote this novel, obviously it might have some type of scandalous content, but nobody's going to think that you were in the scandalous context because you were writing a novel, because you can do that in your sitting room. But if you're going out in public and mixing with actors who are not particularly reputable people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then it's much more dangerous in terms of your reputation as a lady, as it were. The other thing that happens is a very much a decline in theatrical creativity. Why? Sorry, the glare is too much. I'm going to. Yes, much better. Any idea why the theatre becomes much less creative? And we have this explosion on a sort of, you know, world scale of theatre around the time of Shakespeare, with Shakespeare and Hayward and Middleton and Ben Jonson and Webster and all of these people, first-class English playwrights, Rawley, blah, 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 blah. And then people stop really writing new plays. Why? But why would you think that they couldn't come up with anything new? Because nothing new was happening. Nothing new was happening. I mean, we have things like The Way of the World, which is fantastic. So people could come up with new plays. I imagine it's a little bit like the world of plays now, and I would say especially, although I am thankfully as ignorant as possible about the world of musicals, it's much easier to put on Hamlet because everybody's heard of it and sort of feels, oh, I ought to have seen that because everybody's heard of it, than to put on a new play by some new person who people are not very aware of. It's quite an expensive endeavor to put on a play. You have to employ quite a lot of people. And most of the focus in the theatre from in the 18th century is on having productions and sort of special effects and things like that, rather than putting on new plays which could be a flop in terms of, you know, and this happens, the same thing that's happening in Hollywood. In Hollywood you have second parts and third parts, if you like, which is ultimately the same sort of process. It's safer commercially to go for what is known than to go for new, interesting thing. And such is the state of cinema. But that was made much worse from 1737 by the Licensing Act, which was a new bit of censorship in relation to plays. It was really a consequence of Gay's play, John Gay's play, or musical, The Beggar's Opera, from 9 years earlier. The Beggar's Opera made some quite cutting jokes against the government at the time. And there was like one of the thieves in the, and it's basically it's a story about, sort of, or it's very much related to the Newgate calendar and the criminal world, etc. And it's drawing a parallel between the upper class and the criminal class, basically. But there's even, I mean, they even use the Prime Minister's nickname as the name of one of the crooks in the thing, etc. And I think it was William Pitt? Possibly. No, Walpole. Robert Walpole, who was the Prime Minister at the time, saw this play and laughed along. You know, he was intelligent enough to see that if he took offence, that would make it look even worse. But then they made damn sure that they eventually brought in new laws to control what you could say in the theatre. So, again, you could write a new play, start the act of acting and preparing, etc., etc., and suddenly the censor comes along and says, no, you can't do this. Which, again, a huge waste of money. Whereas if Hamlet or whatever, you know, some older play has already been passed. And also there is this idea from the periodical essays of, you know, saying that this is the canon, this is things that you should have seen, etc. There was, if you like, free promotion of past culture because of that. Then it's much easier just to do old theatre rather than new theatre. There are moments of new theatre coming out. There's a moment in the 1770s where there are a series of very, very good comedy of manners. The Rivals, She Stoops to Conquer, and The School for Scandal, which She Stoops to Conquer is by Goldsmith, and The Rivals and The School for Scandal were written by Sheridan, by Richard Sheridan. And that fantastic plays. And actually, almost sort of for the first time, you're actually seeing comedy where you're not thinking, this would be funny at the time because they're actually fun to watch as such, you know, and you can understand them easily, et cetera, et cetera. In a previous iteration of this course, we did look a little bit at, what did we study? School for Scandal, I think it was. But I mean, there wasn't enough time. But they are actually, if you ever get the opportunity to see any of those plays, they are actually quite fun to watch. It's weird because they very much sort of take up the baton of The Way of the World. But there's a 70 years gap between these three plays and that. But then there's another appalling period of nothing in the British theatre until we have Oscar Wilde and then George Bernard Shaw, and then there is some 20th century theatre. But whereas sort of most, you know, for example, novel writing, it goes through different genres that you might think are better or worse, but there's people from 1720 to now continuously writing novels, and there are, you know, regularly masterpieces. But the theatre is also all the way through, because there's just periods where there's nothing of any importance being written. So it's a little bit weird, the history of theatre. But that's a little bit also why, I mean, we have this strange situation where you will, you know, you're studying a couple of centuries of literature, and you study one play, and there's no, you can't really relate it to anything. And next year in Pensamiento y Creación en la Primera Mitad del Siglo XX, which is the name of the course, you study one play and then there's nothing really to relate it to, etc. Because it's not sort of uniform in the sense of the way. So, a lot of playwrights, you know, have free time, if you like, to start experimenting with novels. And you're moving from a situation where novels are, to some extent, somewhat salacious, somewhat sort of racy and scandalous, to, as the century progresses, you have serious writers involved in writing novels. And as you start to have sort of top-level writers trying to write novels, it becomes much more acceptable to write novels. So, I mean, things like Moll Flanders and certainly Fanny Hill are not acceptable in high society. Moll Flanders is, we can recognize it as a great novel. Virginia Woolf could recognize it as a great novel. At the time, it was a popular novel, but not something that people would consider important literature because it was a little bit too scandalous. But by the time you have people like Fielding and the other Richardson, etc., and Lawrence Stern, of course, etc., writing novels, then you can then they become sort of accepted as literature. And because you have those people writing novels, women can be much more public about writing novels, and you can have the first sort of great and successful female novelists like Fanny Burney, etc. But we will talk more about them in the future. So, how are we doing? Okay. Half an hour. How were economic conditions conducive to the rise of the novel? No? Okay, so capitalism began to spread. What do you mean? What is capitalism? Right. Okay. So we begin to have that as a system, as to some extent a national system, rather than just the person, the local person who has cows, well, it's the person who sells you the milk, and blah, 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 blah. But you begin to have a grid of trade, as it were, of commerce. And so you begin to have very much the idea that you can benefit from economies of scale. By producing more efficiently, you can lower prices and therefore get bigger and bigger markets and start selling things on the other side of the world, etc. And of course, part of the whole process that generates the money that is around in a society, apart from basically slavery, is world trade, is globalization, which is something that becomes very sort of real at this time. And so that affects, as you, I think, mentioned earlier, that we have a more efficient printing process where you can print in larger quantities and more cheaply. And if you are selling books more widely, then you can reduce prices. And if you can reduce prices, you can sell books more widely, etc. And we have a distribution system that can actually cope with that. I mean, we have that system on the one hand in terms of the Royal Mail, and you have mail delivered every day in London at this time, and mail delivered three times a week outside London. So, I mean, it's very much a situation where you have, like, London is one world and the rest of the United States, the rest of Britain, is another world. By the early 19th century, it's really crazy how efficient the Royal Mail is. There were 5 deliveries a day, which meant that people could go to work, see what workload they had, and send a letter home saying, I'm going to be back for lunch or not. It's almost, I mean, it's not emails, but it's almost like that. I mean, it's difficult to imagine a postal service working that efficiently. It's within London, it's not outside London. But it really does become a sort of modern system where the sort of efficiency that we would want from new technologies is being produced through old technology. So, I mean, some of these people are quite impressive in their systems, and that's... there's a quite an important Indian economist who studied the way that the British Empire worked, and it worked basically, according to him, like a computer. So you had, for example, people were trained to be, to have reading and writing and arithmetic, so they could be imperial servants in India or Canada or Hawaii or whatever. You know, you could just plop somebody down and they would work in an integrated system based on sending bits of paper by ship. So it's obviously a slower system, but it was actually very much like a computer. And the education system which we have inherited is largely based on this system, which was generated to feed the British Empire and its trading process. The way the education that we receive has nothing to do with the modern world, and it's not particularly useful, unfortunately, but that is why it developed in the way that it did. Anyway, that's another problem. So you then have a sufficient market for books to sell successfully. And that means that you can write for the market. So all sorts of people who could not before write for an aristocratic patron can suddenly write books. Because, again, a capitalist is going to see, is this book going to make me money? It's not going to worry about who you are or where you come from, et cetera, et cetera. They're interested in money. So who benefits most from that? Women. Women were not, I mean, if you like, it's almost ironic in the 20th and 21st century, but women were not employed as private secretaries. Well, private secretaries were male. And so most of the writers, like John Donne, were male, because they could get an income as a private secretary and then write things in their free time, as it were. So women can start to actually write things and actually make, if they're successful, make an incredible amount of money. Evelina by Fanny Burney earned as much from this one novel, she earned as much money as she would from 100 years of working as a governess. Now this was, if you like, the most, I think, the most successful female novel of the 18th century. But even having said that, you know, 100 years of alternative employment from one novel, this is attractive, an attractive way of making money. And again, then you're not sort of, you're not exposing yourself in public, you're not putting yourself in danger in any sort of way by writing novels. So, writing novels becomes a very, very attractive option, especially for women. That, of course, is also helped by a process of increased literacy. There are more readers, so there is more potential for that. There are lower prices and greater output due to new printing methods, and there's a rising standard of living, so there's more disposable income available to the middle classes and more free time for leisure pursuits among the middle classes. So the economies of scale and all of these things make a virtuous circle where you just, the book market just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because all of the factors are working in the same direction. And so we can say things like, the novel arose entirely a product of the commercial ethos of the late 17th and 18th century book trade. Novels were a source of revenue aimed to satisfy popular tastes. For the first time, it is the market that decides what gets written. Not aristocrats, not the rich, not the church, but the market. Ordinary people are the dictators of what gets written. Specifically, there is a huge increase in the number of women readers caused by taste shifts. Epic and romance have been written, as we said, exclusively by and for men. Novels embraced female characters, interests, and themes. Women's lives, themes, and dreams. And we see, you know, you sort of see the potential for this in things like The Way of the World, which has an equal number of female character, and not just an equal number of female characters, but presumably an equal number of lives. I mean, the female characters are as important as the male characters. You compare that to something like Timon of Athens, where there are two women who speak, and they speak a total of something like three lines in the entire play. It's a huge change. It's obviously part of that is to do with the line of women on stage, but also because women are increasingly recognized as ladies, middle class women, are recognized as sort of full human beings for the first time. And middle class women were increasingly not supposed to work, as we saw, be involved in public life or politics, so they had a lot of free time that could be filled with reading novels. There was also, at the same time, another aspect of the book trade was circulating libraries. So basically somebody with a big wagon driving around with books on it and lending books. And while books became much, much, much cheaper, they were still luxury products, basically. I mean, you know, you didn't just idly pick up a book at an airport, not just because there weren't any airports. So because, you know, it was a serious amount of money that was spent. And originally the authors and the publishers were very suspicious of circulating libraries. They didn't like the idea of somebody lending out, you know, buying the book once and then lending it out. It took them a bit of time to realize that this was fermenting the market, and actually there were a lot of circulating libraries, and that would be selling your product and also marketing your product. People would only think of buying your book, which is an expensive thing, if they'd had a chance to read it or read something else written by you. So circulating libraries were very much in the interest of the publishing industry, not against the interest of the publishing industry. Moreover, we have the whole situation in the periodical essays of book reviews, in the mid-century, that's very much novel reviews. And novels become the staple fare of specialist magazines like the Monthly Review, which started in 1749. I mean, there's comments on novels earlier on in periodicals, but there are, after there's a special sort of title periodical like Keller, or something like that, in Spain. Does Keller still exist? Do you know? The magazine? So just to revise some of those things, increasing number of readers, blah, 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 coffee houses and journals, the whole milieu around periodicals, growing up with the middle class, individual trust in his own abilities, practice of reasonable self-analysis, most readers from middle class women are used to borrow books from circulating libraries, blah, blah, blah. Question. How does the novel relate to bourgeois individualism? Or bourgeois liberalism, if you prefer. Bourgeoisie, yeah. To some extent. Well, if we were to take Moll Flanders as our example, there are not many characters that people would like to feel that they were being reflected in exactly that. But there may be some cases, yeah. Anything else? Well, much more tentatively, we could argue that the experience of the London bourgeoisie is relevant. In a city full of strangers, and remember this is a very new phenomenon, most people lived in places where they basically knew everybody, you saw the same people every day, you knew people's names, you knew their faces, you could not just disappear. In London, for almost the first time, I mean no doubt there are some Aztec cities which were very big, or Rome, or you know, whatever, but you can just go to another part of London and you've disappeared, you no longer exist. So in a city full of strangers, character analysis becomes a useful skill. Similarly, in the emerging multi-denominational society with Anglicans, Catholics, Protestants and Jews rubbing shoulders, seeing the world through the eyes of others was a useful skill, especially seeing the world through the eyes of others who had a different set of illusions to you. In the age of reason, the causes and consequences flow of the novel is satisfying because things happen for a reason, as I mentioned earlier. The novel offered the illusion of a rational universe despite the fact that the deist God had withdrawn from everyday life. So, you're not expecting, you can't just sort of have a conversation with God and if you pray hard enough, something, what you want will happen. Things happen for a reason, and there is a keen interest in understanding the way that that works and the way that other people behave. Yeah, so the whole concept of psychology, the psychology of the other, of empathy, etc., begin to become important. There was an intensified consciousness of selfhood. Individualism and other Enlightenment ideas arriving from continental Europe promoted an interest in the idiosyncrasies of individuals against the generality of types based on humans. Yeah, so things tend to be a little bit archetypal characters before, whereas the focus here is on the individualizing elements. Obviously, there are archetypes, but it's the individualizing elements which are the most important. The focus was increasingly on private lives, and novels were typically read in private, as you say. In contrast to publicly read poetry and drama, which tended to focus on public responsibility. The new prose, the novel, was therefore prosaic in the sense of focusing on everyday experience of ordinary people, not monarchs, heroes, and demigods. And this is one of the ways in which, for example, we could consider that Don Quixote is not a fully mature modern novel. The central characters, a knight and a peasant, are not modern people in a capitalist society. Because they couldn't be, because they haven't emerged yet. Moreover, the extent to which Don Quixote is psychomachia, so for example, we can understand Don Quixote as representing the conflict between what people aspire to be and what they are capable of doing, they're capable of performing. So if you like, Don Quixote, the character Don Quixote, represents the mind and the imagination, and Sancho Panza represents the body and practicalities. This is the sort of conflict or the interaction between those two aspects are, to some extent, what's happening in somebody's mind, in the same way as Othello, you can understand Iago as what's happening within somebody's head, that concept of psychomachia. But that idea of sort of extreme types and the separation of these things rather than the integration within the same character is what we get in modern novels. And so, if you like, if the focus in the sort of biography, the most popular type of biography in the Catholic world was saints' lives, There had been a greater interest in sinners' lives, and if you like, in contrast, things you can learn from what sinners do when they repent, rather than trying to emulate saints, as a sort of Protestant alternative, if you like. But at the same time, we have a situation where we want middling types, people who have good points and bad points, because they are much more easily recognizable. We don't live surrounded by terrible villains and wonderful heroes. That's just not, apart from Trump. So, which existing genres contributed to the emerging novel? Biographies, good. So, for example, we know that Defoe tried to pass off Robinson Crusoe as a genuine memoir. And that was a reasonable thing to do, because Robinson Crusoe was in fact based on the experiences of a man called Selkirk, who featured in one of the periodicals a few years previously. What else? Biographies. Travel writing, good. So Defoe, for example, wrote a tour through Great Britain, and the fact of people sort of travelling around and seeing sights and having different experiences is quite fun anyway, and has, you know, that's all already attractive in romance. What else? Collections of letters. So there's a story about Richardson's development of Pamela as starting off as a letter writing manual. It's not actually true. It could be true, sort of thing. Idea that obviously epistolary novels based on letters going one way and the other are an important part of 18th century and early 19th century. Novel writing. What else? Pamphlets, like the Newgate Calendar. So the stories of rogues and the underworld become of interest, and are incorporated elements of that into the novel. Character sketches in the periodical essays, the individualization of character as seen in the periodicals, it shows the possibilities for creating interesting character sketches. Short stories like Orunoko by Afra Ben, etc. And comic theatre. Once you have something like The Way of the World, you can see the possibility of writing a novel with this these types of adventures and things going on. comic theatre has been described as the womb, the uterus of the novel. It also gives the possibility for, shows the possibility for realistic dialogues. Once you stop writing in verse, you can start worrying about making something seem convincing. If you're writing in verse, it's not even about doing convincing because it's in verse. So, but the other great advantage with novels is that it was not an accepted genre. So there were far fewer rules about how you had to do it. So it was much easier to experiment. There was no established market. So all of the early novelists published in other genres too, and the early novel was therefore a hybrid. People experimenting, and if something worked, it became incorporated into the genre. So there is the, as distinct from poetry and drama, there is the effortless social range. I mean, we've seen some social range in things like Henry V, or The Canterbury Tales. We have different characters from different classes mixing together, but it's just easier in the novels. Because it is freed from generic constraints. There's always in the background in the theatre, there's the unity of time, and the unity of place, and the unity of action. In the background with poetry, there's always, until the Romantics, the concept of poetic diction. You have to write in a certain sort of way. In the novel, you can write whichever way you think is going to be effective for what you're doing. So it's much more free. Although prose fiction had existed since ancient times, it had no theorists, it had no Aristotle, or no Horace, and no traditional rules that hindered its realistic portrayal of contemporary society in all its complexity. So, a novel was judged by how convincing a world it created, and that's it. So, what, start with a quiz. What is a Bildungsroman? Was ist ein Bildungsroman? So, Bildung is related to building, so it is development. Excellent, right. A novel of formation. What is the alternative name in English? I like saying Bildungsroman because it sounds funny. But what is the alternative name in English? A coming-of-age novel. So it's the process of somebody changing from being effectively a child or an adolescent to being an adult, male or female. What is a monologic epistolary novel? Good, okay, so something like Pamela, we largely just get Pamela's letters. We don't get the other side. Whereas in a dialogic epistolary novel, obviously there is an exchange of letters, which is potentially much more satisfying. So Clarissa, the next novel by Richardson, is dialogic, as is Fanny Burney's Evelina. A polylogic epistolary novel, what's that? Yeah, There's letters from all over the place. An example? Very good. Okay, Frankenstein, which you will have the pleasure of reading at Christmas, very Christmassy sort of novel, is polylogic. A memoir novel. What's a memoir novel? A fictional autobiography. An example of which is From Old Flanders, or The Vicar of Wakefield, or Jane Eyre, which you will read in April, or March, April. A novel of character. The greater weight of interest is on the central character's motives for what she or he does and how he or she as a person will turn out. So there's an element of that in Old Flanders, there's certainly an element of that in Pamela. A novel of incident. The greater weight of interest is on what the character will do next and on how the story will come out. So, tends to be adventure-y type situations. Robinson Crusoe would be a good example. And a sentimental novel, or a novel of sentiment, or a novel of sensibility. The object of this type of novel was to illustrate the connection between acute sensibility and true virtue. And adherence to strict morality and honor combined with copious feelings and a sympathetic heart were the hallmarks of a person of sentiment. And a good example of that again is Pamela. So, one of the things that's important for you to realize from that is that you can have one novel which can be within several categories. It's not like they're not exclusive categories. Finally, to finish, in the last 3 minutes, sorry, that was the previous thing. We talked about that as well, right? What do you know about narratology? No? I think science is probably too optimistic. Yes, it's the study of how the narrator creates their character and how the story is created, is narrated. So a narrator can be either extra diegetic or intradiegetic. The narrator can be part of the story or outside the story. Chaucer's narrator is intradiegetic because he's a character in the story, even though a minor one. Whereas the narrator in Tom Jones, for example, is extra diegetic in that he is completely outside the story. An extra diegetic narrator is above or superior to the story he or she narrates. The intradiegetic narrator is inside the fictional work created by the story. We can talk about narrative voice, how the story is told. We can talk about narrative mode, which is how the author conveys the story to the reader, the narrative point of view, plus the narrative voice. We have first-person narrators. The narrator is necessarily a participant. That's what we have in Gulliver's Travels or in Tristram Shandy. A frame narrator reports the actions of others. For example, frame. Well, there is a frame in the Canterbury Tales, but the narrator appears inside the story as well. No, Moll Flanders has a frame narrator, yeah? The narrator appears at the beginning and the end. A limited third-person narrator cannot describe things that are unknown to the focal character. So, it's not the focal character who's talking, not the center of consciousness who's talking, but it's only what they have seen or heard. An omniscient third-person narrator has dominated English literature from the late 18th century novel until the present day. The narrator knows everything about the world. The narrator is effectively a sort of god. a third-person subjective narrator, where the narrator conveys thoughts, feelings, and opinions, etc., of one or more characters. A third-person objective narrator employs a narrator who tells the story without describing any character's thoughts, opinions, or feelings. Instead, gives an objective, unbiased point of view. So it's basically the public world rather than the internal world. Finally, last question, what is narrative transvestism? Okay, so a male author writing a female character, very common in a lot of the early novels, like Moll Flanders or Fanny Hill or Pamela or Clarissa. Male authors take on a first-person narrative voice of a woman. What does this imply?
Maybe they did it because they knew women were the main readers.
Okay. But also it implies that what women think and what women do is actually interesting. Though it hadn't been before. So the big difference, if you like, is for a lot of novels about men, the question is all of the options open to them. Whereas the main focus with novels that focus on women is their highly restricted number of options and the consequences of their choice. So they tend to be quite different stories because women just have fewer options in society, or at least had fewer options in society. But that is quite important at this time. And of course it can work the other way, but it has been less common the other way around. I suppose Harry Potter could be considered a little bit in that sense, although it's not first person. So next week we will look directly at Moll Flanders. Something to look forward to. Have you finished?
Not yet.
Not yet. He's finished. I want this to be very competitive. That's the aim.